Blog Talk Radio.
All right, folks, this is Rebel Rousing Rich Bergeron.
You are with the tornado, Tony Pendecal.
And we have another great show lined up. We do have a little news stemming from the breaking news you brought last week. And I'm going to start off the show with this rain fart there. Just dealing with technical difficulties. Okay, so there's your 10-bell salute for the Macho Man. Not Randy Savage. Macho Camacho.
Yeah.
Died, I think it was Tuesday. They took him off life support.
I know they were looking to pull the plug on Saturday. So, and I know it was shortly after that. I left for vacation on Sunday morning. And I'm pretty sure he was passed away by that time.
All right, and not surprisingly, we do have a story related to that, kind of interesting. Talks about a little bit how his funeral went, and I'm just going to read this report here. By the way, we have Psychic Tom with us. How's it going, Tom?
Good evening. Good evening, gentlemen. Good evening.
Hector Macho Camacho has proved to be as controversial after death as he was during his life. Turns out several fights broke out during the second day of the viewing of the slain fighter Tuesday, including a scratching match between his alleged girlfriend, another woman who says she's his longtime girlfriend, and his sisters, according to local media reports in Puerto Rico. Cynthia Castillo said, "I am the actual girlfriend of Macho, and those who don't like it, dang it. They shouldn't be going after me," she says. "They should be thanking me for being with him at all times." And Castillo kissed Camacho on the mouth at the viewing and then walked to the area reserved for family, where she claimed her plate of food was upended. She then got into an altercation with Gloria Fernandez, who claims to have been Camacho's girlfriend for the past 25 years, as well as Camacho's sisters, Esther and Estrella. And as Castillo again says, "I went to get something to eat because Machito, who's Hector Camacho Jr., told me to, and his ex-girlfriend, Fernandez, came up to me and told me that I had to leave. I said no, so they threw my plate of food and attacked me, and I defended myself." And there was also pushing and shoving between former bantamweight champ Wilfredo Vasquez and Jorge Lozada, who said he's a member of the Camacho, after Lozada allegedly tried to separate Vasquez's wife and Camacho's mother as the two embraced. How that could have escalated. Why would have done that, but that's part of this one. But on a positive note, for 2 days, hundreds of people filed past Camacho's open casket displayed inside a gymnasium decked out for the occasion with black carpet and curtains. The boxer wore white along with a large gold crucifix and a necklace spelling out his nickname, Macho, in capital letters. And on Thursday, he was flown to New York, where fans saw the legend first emerge as a symbol of Puerto Rico's rich prize-fighting lineage. So viewing for family members took place today, and then the fans will be able to pay their respects at a public viewing tomorrow from 3 p.m. to 10 p.m. at the St. Cecilia's Church in Camacho's old neighborhood, according to a spokeswoman at St. Cecilia's. And the funeral mass will be held Saturday starting at 9 a.m., and he will be laid to rest at St. Raymond's Cemetery in the Bronx. and as we talked about last week, but we didn't get the full details. He was shot outside a bar in his hometown of Bayamón, Puerto Rico. The friend that was with him died at the scene, and he suffered a gunshot wound to the jaw, and it came out through his shoulder. So, basically, you know, he would have been paralyzed if he'd lived, brain dead, if they didn't take him off life support. So they just, the family came together, had some time with him, and they pulled the plug, basically. Police have suspects, but they have not arrested anyone. They did find 9 bags of cocaine on the friend, and 1 bag open in the car. That was one big detail from the police reports that was left out of a lot of the initial reports, and then it kind of finally came out. But that was kind of made it look like something that had to do with money. It had to be over money because they must have just paid for all that stuff. And whoever shot him saw that go down. It's my theory. And they wanted the money, the rest of the money. I don't know. We'll see. I don't know if they're going to be really investigating it that hard, but we may find out soon what really happened there.
Now, I wonder if we have any, do we have any YouTube videos of the funeral brawl? Do you know if anything's come out yet on that? That would be, I can imagine, it sounds so disrespectful to say that, but in this society, everything is, you know, everything's a spectacle. I was just kind of wondering what kind of a scene that would have been. I can imagine.
Yeah. We'll see. I don't know. But I guess Macho's legacy and his spirit, I guess, would be proud to know that the women were still fighting over him even as he lay in his casket.
You know, and I was reviewing some of the stories about him, and, you know, Tony, I kind of always shared your view. I was never really a big fan of his attitude and a lot of things, but the one thing that I think he deserves to be remembered by is he did have that attitude, anyone, anytime, anywhere. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, that was such an old school throwback in that sense. I mean, you know, like, but I mean, I share your opinion. I mean, his style was not really one of my favorites, his manner of dress, his manner of talk, his manner of disrespect, and so many other things. But that's the one thing. I can't ever think of anyone that he ducked or he came up with an excuse or that he showed up out of shape. It was always in that sense that I'll try to remember the good stuff. But I remember the bad, too. You know, I'm like you there, but there were some fairly good reviews of him.
Well, like I said, when I really started getting into boxing was, you know, I watched a lot of it as a kid. Then I started getting back into right around the mid-90s when Tyson was getting on the scene and then guys like, you know, watching a lot of the fights on network TV with my dad, you know, I was a big Vinny Taliendo fan. So, you know, him and Macho fought. That was right during the time when Vinny was having so much trouble making weight that he lost like 3 straight fights because he was killing himself. But the fight that I think bothered me the most with Camacho was his fight with Ray Boom Boom Mancini. And, you know, Boom Boom had come out of retirement and been retired a couple of years. And the man clearly won the fight, and they gave it to Camacho. And you're right, there's the level of disrespect. So after that, I just wanted to see anybody beat him. Anybody. And I was never a Greg Howden fan. And when he beat Camacho, I literally jumped out of my chair. And when Camacho finally, the one thing I will give him a lot of credit on, if you go to 3 of his losses, you go, I think like 78 and 6 and 2 or something like that. But 3 of his losses, one was against Julio Cesar Chavez. That was his first, you know, major defeat. And Chavez pummeled him. Terrible. Had his eyes swollen shut. He really beat him up. And the fact of the matter is, Camacho went to 12 rounds. He held a lot. He held and he ran, but he stayed in there. And one of them, in his fight with Oscar De La Hoya, which was on my 21st birthday, KO Magazine, it was either KO or Ring Magazine, summed it up best. And it goes, talking about the heart of a fighter, and it mentioned him specifically in this fight. It goes, imagine taking Oscar De La Hoya's best left hook 30 seconds into the first round and realizing you got 11 rounds, 2 minutes, and 30 seconds more of that to take, and standing up and taking it, and that's what he did. And yes, whether you like the guy or you hate him, you've got to give him credit for that, because that fight with De La Hoya was a pretty savage beating.
Exactly.
I mean, I'm sure that was his idea of being so flashy and in your face, was to have as many haters as he had.
You know what?
Definitely a good boxer. You got to give him that.
You know, look at some of the most successful professional wrestlers out there that have been bad guys.
Right.
You know, they make money off you hating them. So
sure.
Ric Flair was probably one of the most successful bad guys in the history of wrestling.
It's kind of funny you mentioned wrestling, because the only good Ken Bell salute that I could find was for a wrestler on YouTube. Umaga. Okay.
But I mean,
I
so if anybody wants a good audio video of a, it's actually pretty much better for the audio, but Ten Bell salute, just look up Umaga on YouTube. Ten Bell Umaga.
Umaga.
Right. But anyway, switching to current boxing, I did actually watch the full Guerrero versus Berto fight this last weekend. Surprisingly, I sat in front of the computer here and watched the whole thing. And I was really impressed with Guerrero, but Berto, I kept screaming for that uppercut before he really started landing it, really. But by the time he really started landing, he couldn't see where it was going.
Yeah, I see that picture of him afterwards, and it was hideous.
Yeah, it was an interesting fight because, you know, right off the bat, Guerrero kind of got away with a lot of things. The first knockdown, he was holding the back of his head with one hand, and then hitting him with the other, and the ref didn't really call it. Wasn't really pulling with the hand, but he was definitely kind of holding the head in position. So that's a little mixed martial arts coming into boxing, but it worked out well for him. And the announcers actually didn't even see it until the replay, but I thought it was kind of surprising. I saw it right away. So I don't know if there's any excuse there for the ref not to have warned him or whatever. But anyway, that was the first knockdown. And Berto just never really recovered from there. He was throwing the uppercut and just really nailing Guerrero late in the fight. Guerrero actually came out with a puffy eye all of a sudden after one round. But if Berto had been throwing those things in the very beginning, that was the secret weapon, because Guerrero was coming in with, you know, one hit tied up and the other one hitting, whether it's to the body or to the head. So he was doing a lot of that inside fighting, punching with one hand and just doing it in bunches. Even if it wasn't really a hard punch, he was throwing it. And that was really his whole strategy. And when that kind of fell apart, what's getting through, he didn't look too good at the end of the fight. We only lost one round, according to the the HBO scoring. So, it was a good fight, I thought. But Berto is just, I guess there was a reason why he got begged for the performance-enhancing drugs there. He's probably feeling at the tail end of his career. But Guerrero's definitely looking good. He could definitely show some more improvement. But he's been calling out Floyd Mayweather for a while. And that might be the kind of fight that maybe Mayweather would watch and say, maybe I could beat this guy.
Yeah. I mean, Robert Guerrero's been a very underrated fighter his whole career. He was a good junior lightweight champion. And then, unfortunately, because of his personal issues with his wife being sick with breast cancer. You know, a lot of times you hear that fighter having personal issues, and he's having drug problems. You know, he's getting sent to jail or what if alcohol problems, and that disrupts their career. And then you hear about a guy like Robert Guerrero, knew how to take time away from his career to take care and be with his wife, who was sick. And, you know, thank the Lord, he's doing well now. And you look at that guy, and it's almost impossible not to root for him. You know, he's always been an exciting fighter. I've always enjoyed watching him. I unfortunately did not get to see Saturday Night's fight. I wasn't feeling very well. I took some medicine. Not to be the first fight ended. But, you know, he's a fighter. I mean, he stepped up in weight, and he fought, you know, a guy that was a legitimate world champion, and he beat him. You know, it was a close fight, but the fact of the matter is he knocked him down twice, and he beat him. And I know a lot of people would start to fight pretty convincingly, and the fact of the matter is he didn't win, and he was beaten convincingly.
Yeah, the fight was totally Guerrero's, and Berto just didn't seem to hit him. But it's partly due to his style. I mean, he kept one hand by his waist almost the whole fight, you know, waist, chest area. And it's just not going to cut it when you don't have the shoulder roll style like Mayweather or some of the other fighters that use that. Or you don't have the head movement, you know. If you just kind of stand there and wait for your opening while you're holding your hand by your chest, you're going to get pummeled. He did. You know, so he's definitely got to work on that defense, whether it's moving more or putting that hand back up. He kind of had like the half-ass Archie Moore, mongoose, George Foreman guard, you know, going for some of the body shots, but, you know, he didn't really use it effectively.
Yeah, I think that's a very effective style if you can apply it. Ken Norton had a style kind of like that. He was able to make it work quite a bit, but it's not easy.
Yeah, you gotta. I mean, you basically leave your body open if you're gonna block your head. If you use that style right, you know, George Foreman used to be good at it because he just kind of ducked his head under, put his arms up, and so you're throwing hooks at him. You're gonna hit his elbow, and that's gonna hurt.
Yeah.
You're probably not gonna try that too often.
Yeah.
Anyway. It was definitely a good fight. Not the best I've seen, but I think it shows that Guerrero has some real good strengths and a few weaknesses. The uppercut, number one. He was getting, I mean, really nailed with those. You know? And they showed some of the replays. It was really bad. But he was definitely born with a good chin because he took them all and kept going. So, looking forward to seeing what happens next with him. Everybody still here?
Still here.
All right. One sign out there for a second. I got worried. All right. Well, we're trying to connect with a fighter from the 30th anniversary of the Battle of the Badges. All right, we're back. I don't know what the last thing you guys heard was.
One of the last things I heard, you were talking about the gentleman we're going to have as a guest tonight, and you said it was the 30th anniversary of the Battle of the Badges.
Oh, really? That's the last thing? You know, a while ago then. Yeah, we're gonna try to connect with Philippe Irizarry. I know I definitely saw him in action in at the Foxwoods event. If you, the New England Law Enforcement versus FDNY circuit that I've been to three times now, I think. And they're actually going to have another one early next year. but it's going to be a big event. I think the FDNY is ahead, but I'll have to ask Philippe about that just to make sure. But 30 years they've been doing it, and we've had Bobby McGuire on before, the coach. He actually set us up with this interview, so you know, Bobby's always a good talk. Good story there. He's one of the original guys to start the team in the first place, so he knows a lot about it. And it's just it's a great team. The guys are all real sportsmanlike, and it's always a good show. They definitely hold their own in the amateur circuit. Some of these guys who fight for the FDNY. I don't know about the NYPD, but. They really do take it seriously, and nine times out of ten, they win against these Massachusetts guys. So, I don't know what it's going to take for those guys to turn the tide. It's going to have to be a miracle, judging by some of the fights I've seen. We'll talk to Philippe. Hey, Matt, now once we reconnect Tom. Tom's back.
All right.
And let's get Philippe's connected. And he's a 152-pounder. I know who he's going to fight. I'll have to ask him about that, too.
Hello?
Hello, Philippe.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Rich Bergeron from Fight News Unlimited. How's it going?
How's it going?
Good. We also have Tony the Tornado on the line and a psychic Tom.
How you doing, Philippe?
What's going on, fellas? Hey, what's going on?
So tell us a little bit about this big event, the 30th anniversary of the Battle of the Badges down there between you guys and the NYPD.
Well, is that the Garden? It's a big event at the Garden with all the great sport, and we're going in there to do our thing.
All right. And you're at 152 pounds?
Yeah, I'm fighting actually this year a little heavier at 152.
All right. And did you guys, did you have a fight up at that Foxwood show not too long ago with the New England law enforcement?
Yeah, unfortunately, I wasn't able to fight in that one, but the other guys did. It was a pretty good turnout.
All right. Have you fought in those ones before up in the Boston area there?
No, I haven't. I haven't debuted up there yet.
Oh, so I haven't even seen you. I thought I would have seen you because I've gone to all those shows. I think I missed one over the years, the first one and then one after that, but... It's a pretty good team. I've talked to Bobby a bunch of times, Bobby McGuire, and it seems like you guys definitely take it seriously. What's it like, training and getting ready for this big? This is like the mega event for you guys, right?
This is the big one, you know, because we're going against our own NYPD, so we definitely want the bragging rights, and we want to be on top, you know.
And what's the, I was just talking about this, what's the total rivalry? What's the win-loss total there?
I think we're up 34-31, something like that. I think we're up by like three.
Wow. Sounds like it's very competitive.
Yeah. I mean, the past... Well, within the past 4 years, we won three, and last year we came back. We were down 4-0, and we came back and tied it. So last year was a tie.
Awesome.
So this year we definitely don't want to tie. We want to be on top.
All right. Well, give us a breakdown. How did you get involved in firefighting in the first place? What brought you to New York and the New York Fire Department?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you there.
What got you into firefighting in the first place?
I'm a city kid. I'm a Bronx kid. I grew up in the Bronx, so, you know, just watching them respond to calls and passing through the area where I grew up, just, you know, curious and, you know, just gave me that that's the one to, you know, do something different. And as I learned about the job, I learned to like it more and more, and, you know, like a relationship, I fell in love with it.
And what's been your best moment so far on the job?
Oh, man, I have to say training and fighting with the fire department. You know, we've been lucky enough to travel San Diego, money for the Wounded Warrior Project, and, helping people out. So, you know, I'll tell you that's been, you know, a blessing itself, you know.
Yeah, I definitely, it gets the feeling. I mean, watching it, you get the feeling. It's kind of like a movement, this team. It's not just a team. I mean, it's just, it's the whole FDNY behind it. And, it's just an amazing show anywhere they go. And, you know, I definitely noticed how seriously the fighters take it. And they go out there, they show good sportsmanship. And they always seem to beat up the New England guys. I haven't seen one where they won. I think the only time where the New England guys won was the one that I missed. But it's intense.
Yeah. I mean, we definitely want to make the FD proud, you know, and it's nothing better than hearing them chant for you. You know, the crowd is amazing. You know, it's something you chills, you know, and it's definitely a proud moment, you know.
Now, had you done any fighting at all before you joined the fire department? Or just kind of stuff?
Yeah, that was the beauty of it, because before I got on the FDNY, I was an amateur boxer trying to turn pro. And once I got on, you know, I didn't go the pro route, but I was able to continue boxing through the FD, you know, and you know, it's, like I said, you know, I got to fight. Before, I never got to fight at Garden or at the Roseanne Ballroom or at, at the special, you know, events, BBQs and stuff. And with the FD, I was able to do that. And having, you know, the biggest crowd of the FD cheering for you, you know, it's one more I can ask for, you know. So it's definitely serious, you know, because I've been doing it before. So, you know, it's definitely a little more for me, you know.
Right. Now, I come from law enforcement family myself, and I don't really know offhand the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it. Isn't there a rival, kind of a natural rivalry? I mean, I know it's different in New York, too, but isn't there just a natural rivalry between police and fire guys? You know, it's friendly, but it's kind of a natural thing, right?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I guess it is, you know, because I feel that the public, like, you know, they relate to us more and they appreciate us a little more compared to the cops. So I guess that kind of get under the skin and, you know.
So you guys do any trash talking back and forth before the fights?
Yeah, we do. We do press conferences out here in New York and, you know, so.
And what do you know about your opponent?
I don't really know much at all, you know. I'm not used to knowing too much about my opponent. Usually it's just like a one day, you know, you go in, you weigh in, you match, you get matched up, you know, according to your experience. So I don't really know too much about him. All I know is that his name is Tuesday and he's a cop, New York City cop. So that's the guy I'm going against.
His name is Tuesday?
Tuesday.
He married to Girl Friday?
I'm fighting Tuesday and we're fighting Saturday. So.
Oh, no. That's like a who's on first joke waiting to happen.
and then let's not forget Sergeant Friday from Dragnet, you know. That's,
that's awesome. Well, what do you like in general? Hello?
Yeah.
What do you enjoy most about boxing?
I say the working out. you know, it keeps me in shape, you know, for the job and in general. It keeps me, I love, you know, I just love the competition, being in the ring, trying to figure, you know, the other person out. And, you know, just, you know, it just keeps you thinking, you know. It keeps you, this is never, you never can master, you can never master boxing. It's always a growing sport. And, you know, you as a person, you're always growing because you're always learning different things.
Right. Awesome.
Yeah.
And do you have any favorite fighters that you watched growing up or that you...
I mean, I was a big De La Hoya fan, you know, growing up. I mean, I would say De La Hoya, like, you know, growing up. Now I'm more of an Andre Ward fan.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Just said he's going to fight Kelly Pavlik.
Yeah, I was going to say that just got announced just a few days ago. I think Ward right now is too skilled, and I don't know if Pavlik has enough left. I like Kelly Pavlik, but I just don't think he can compete with Ward's skill and speed.
Yeah, Ward is like, he's amazing right now. He's on top, dude. He is prime. You know, Pavlik, I mean, he could, you know, he has some power, but I don't think he can handle Andre Ward.
No, I don't think so either. He's just signing a fight to get a paycheck. But his name's been thrown around a lot. He's a big name in the sport, so people want to get him on the record. And everybody thinks they can beat him, so he's definitely a dark horse. We'll see if he can pull off the upset, but I think it's highly doubtful.
That
did. But anyway, Sleep, do you have a favorite punch?
I would say I like my hook.
Left or right, or both?
Oh, my left hook.
All right.
I mean, last year I knocked out the guy with a straight right hand, but, you know, I'm a natural lefty, and my father just gave, you know, I'm a natural lefty, so my father always gave me the right hand since he was a righty. So my hook is a little stronger, you know, than my right hand.
Yeah, I always liked the left hook myself, but I was a right-handed fighter. So, yeah.
It's funny. I mean, I've always been such a left hook guy that a lot of times during my fighting career, I would drop guys with the right hand, even though my right hand was significantly inferior to my left. And even though I was right-handed, I was a left hook guy. And the guys would focus so much on my left, I'd hit it with the right and I'd catch them off guard.
Tony's just sick over there. He's having trouble.
I've been battling the sickness since last Saturday. And then, like the Einstein that I am, as sick as a freaking dog, I spent hours out in the woods. It's nursing, a wet nursing. So I got a coffin. And now, but where did all this come from? From the brilliant idea that I was going to work outside last week in a sleeveless shirt.
At the tree line?
Yeah, that's me.
Oh, man. All right, so the tree lot looking like it was a summer sale?
Yeah, you know what? Christmas
in July?
You got to do anything you can to get the people's attention. And, you know, that's what I do. And on Black Friday, I work from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m., and from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., I was sleeveless. And I sleeveless hang on. You know, it was hot for a while, then for a while, I wouldn't put it on until the one guy left, because I didn't want him to...
That works,
you know,
if you do it as your road work, but not when you're standing around.
Yeah. I get to work tomorrow night, so... Oh, by the way, I'm also trying... which I got, and I'm not smart enough to own a smartphone, but I have it anyway.
Well, Philippe, is there anything else you wanted to kind of add about the event itself, who benefits, all that kind of stuff?
I mean, it's if you've never been to the Garden to see a FD PD fight, I mean, it's electrifying. I mean, the crowd, it's a loud arena, fun arena, and the crowd definitely gets into it, you know. So, I'm proud of the guys. You know, we work real hard for this event, and we go out there and we try our best, you know. So, December 8th.
December 8th, Madison Square Garden.
Madison Square Garden.
So now, what's your record going into this one?
Like 6-2, fighting with FD. The overall, I'm about like 28-7.
Nice.
Like 28-7.
Well, I'm glad you got the opportunity there. I'll definitely have to keep an eye out on you. I know that the FDNY is going to come back up to the New England area, I think in March, for the next one up there. So I could possibly be at that one. If you fight there, I'll probably see you fight then. But definitely wish you luck. Hopefully you won't need it. That skill. And definitely appreciate what you guys do and you know, raising money for the Wounded Warriors and all that. And I know how important a big event like this can be. And definitely, it's just great to be a part of something like that. So, and thanks for your service to the city of New York as well.
Thanks.
Well, it's been great talking to you. And Battle of the Badges 30th anniversary on December 8th. So get your tickets. And we'll be posting stuff on the blog about this and also on battleofthebadges.info, which is a site that I've been running for the New England guys initially. But I also help besides the other FDNY stuff going on. So you have a great night, Philippe, and thanks for stopping by and chatting with us.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having us.
Good luck, Philippe.
Good luck, baby.
All right.
Have
a good one. Thanks. So there you have it. Philippe here is a celebrity who is So look out for him. Down there in New York City, the Madison Square Garden. It's going to be a big show. But we were discussing a little bit when we broke up earlier. I think I was trying to start a story about Freddie Roach talking about Manuel Marquez not being a natural at his weight. Which is kind of odd because, you know, Floyd. So you guys heard that part?
Yes.
Okay. So basically, you know, the contention that Roach is making is that Marquez is doing it unnaturally. We'll see. I don't know if they're going to have Olympic style testing for this one, like Mayweather asked for. But, you know, he's leveling those accusations. A guy like that usually doesn't do that unless he knows something. Especially considering the whole flap with the defamation lawsuit with Mayweather. Speaking of PEDs, actually, I saw a story on CNN this morning about, I think it was like 3 or 4 NFL guys just got suspended for Adderall.
Phillies got suspended for that.
Somebody from the Phillies?
Yeah, Carlos Reed, the catcher.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was a guy from the Patriots on the defense that took, it was one of them. So I guess that's why the defense has been so focused lately.
Pun intended, huh? Yeah, we had someone from the Cleveland Browns, Joe Hayden. He was suspended for 4 games. What is the advantage of this? I've never tried it myself. What is it?
Well, I think I've only hit one or two of them myself, but back when I was in college, I had a friend who had ADD, and he took Ritalin. And I would take it when I'd have to do, like, a paper. And I would just be up, like, for, like, 20 hours working on my paper. And it's just natural speed, you know? And I actually used to just take half a pill at a time because it's had such a different effect on me than somebody who actually had ADD. And I imagine Adderall is the same thing. And I mean, I would just I'd organize my whole room at school and like get it in military school condition after taking a half a Ritalin. So I can imagine an Adderall to a football player is pretty intense.
All right. So in other words, the NFL and probably even sporting commissions, you know, for boxing and MMA have determined that this is a performance-enhancing drug. Where's the edge at?
It's just brain and the brain, basically. You think better, you make better decisions, and you're just locked on target, basically. And they've actually given this type of stuff to fighter pilots. That's what led to the incident up there in I forget what country it was, but I think like 10 Canadians got killed by this fighter pilot, and his defense was that he was on too many stimulants that they gave him. They told him to take. They made him take before his mission. So.
Well, then where was the edge for him? You see where I'm going with this? I mean, I would think. I'm not saying it's a guaranteed advantage. I mean, it didn't sound like it was to him. You see.
I get it
with steroids. You know, we can argue that forever, but I can see where I can see the logic behind it. If your strength increases and your cardio increases, but Adderall, I'm having trouble getting. I guess I'll have to try some myself, you know, and see what I think of it. But right now, I'm just
I've actually had somebody explain, you know, what the ADD medication does to their head. And when they described it, it's like there's receptors in your brain that open and close, you know, to receive information and process it. People who have ADD, their receptors either go too fast or too slow. So they take it, and this is kind of a weird thing, but some drugs actually speed it up even faster to slow it down if it's too fast.
Yeah, okay, I suppose I could. But yet, I understand if a doctor prescribes it for you, then that's okay. I don't know, strange rules. Strange rules, because then you...
You don't need it. It's just like speed. It's like pure speed. So it's definitely an advantage in a lot of respects. But the other funny story that came out of it was they were talking to another guy about the incident, and he said that there's actually some football players out there who had decided to take Viagra prior to games.
Now, that really doesn't make sense.
Blood flow. But, you know, I don't know if they have to the side effects of blindness. Maybe that's what the refs are thinking. Anyway, there's another funny story. I'm just going to read this right down. Ronda Rousey's appearance on Jim Rome last night. And I think this is from MMA fighting. Here it goes. Let her bang, bro. Strikeforce women's bantamweight champion Ronda Rousey likes to raise her testosterone levels prior to fight night, but isn't going to mess around with testosterone replacement therapy or mystery pills from some meathead at the gym. Her solution? Bang Fest. For girls, it raises your testosterone, so I try to have as much sex as possible before I fight, actually. Not with, like, everybody. I don't put out, like, a Craigslist ad. But if I got a steady, I'm going to be like, yo, fight time's coming up. And Rousey talked to Jim Rome via MMA Weekly about abstinence as it pertains to mixed martial arts training. There is a general consensus among top trainers, including Freddie Roach, can be detrimental to a male athlete. That may not be the case with the ladies, which could explain why Ronda gets rowdy during camp. Giggity. So, that was a funny little story I saw. I figured it would be a good addition to the show. Dana White obviously has got to be sticking his face in the news and his mouthpiece out there about everything. So, what is Dana White bitch and moan is about injuries. There's been a lot of cancellations, injured fighters pulling out of fights, a lot of damage done to the promotion because of that. You're even having these Strikeforce fights, their last promotional event. Guys are getting injured, backing out of fights. So now Dana White has come out and says to tone it down. Tone your training down a little bit. Let's not get anybody injured this last week and a half, he says. So basically, he's trying to blame it all on the training of these fighters. They train too hard. That's why they're getting injured. And this is a familiar refrain from him. But basically, the reason why he's so amped up and protective about this card, it's UFC on Fox 5 coming up on December 8th, also the same night as Pacquiao and the Battle of the Badges. So, going to be a real fight night.
Well, you see, that I think the problem with what he said there, and both you guys know, it's a fine line. I mean, you don't want to leave it all in the gym. But on the other hand, you can't do it halfway. And I think each guy has his, you know yourself, but I would be more inclined to push a little harder. So, because if they take his advice and really tone things down and then you wind up out of gas after the first round, then he's upset about that. So I don't know. I don't think there's a magic formula for toning it down.
Yeah. Well, I think that it goes along the same lines of what I always complain about, the fact that Dana has never fought a fight in his life.
Right, right.
And that just taints his commentary in so many ways, and people just give him a pass for it for the most part. But this is one of those incidents where somebody needs to pull this guy aside and explain to him that, hey, buddy, you know, these guys train every day, and there's a lot of times where they get injured, and it's not even during this full combat training. It's something just totally unrelated.
Right.
You know, it could still be during training, but it's not because you're training too hard. There was a guy that we had on, I think, a few months ago, actually probably over a year ago now, I want to say, who got injured in the minutes before the fight, jumping around in the training room, the dressing room, where they do the workouts prior to the fight. And he broke his ankle real bad, tore ligaments. And he just got signed by the UFC, so they paid for the surgery. But, I mean, he was supposed to be making his debut, and he hurt himself.
And years ago that happened with Kevin Randleman. When he was backstage, I think he slipped and knocked himself out or something like that. So, I mean, it can happen, but the bottom line is when you get in that ring or that cage, you're fighting for your life. I mean, it's a deadly serious business. And to slack off in training, I don't know, I don't get it.
I'll tell you one of my favorite stories about a fighter getting injured started. I'm going to bring up a very famous fighter, and I'm sure you guys are going to remember him. This is not the fighter that got injured. And, Rich, I know you know this fighter very well. Marvelous Marvin Hagler. Who's heard of him?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course.
First fight in.
So, I know, Rich, you work out with the Petronellis. Well, a lot of us, if you remember Hagler during his career, when he would get in the ring, you know, before fighting, he'd psycho himself up, he would punch himself in the forehead. It was a lot. A fighter, and I don't remember the guy's name, I just remember reading about it, young prelim fighter, maybe even making his pro debut, I don't remember, gets in the ring and was trying to psych himself up a la Marvin Hagler, starts punching himself in the face, but not on his forehead, in his actual face, broke his nose.
Wow.
Basically TKO'd himself before the fight.
Yeah. That's wild.
Hey, there's no way you'll see me right now.
I actually shouldn't say anything because I punched myself in the face this morning trying to just start a chainsaw. It wasn't very hard, though. I didn't break anything. I didn't bust my lip. So, but anyway, UFC on Fox 5 is a big event. Ben Henderson's going to be fighting against Nate Diaz for the lightweight championship. Light heavyweights Mauricio Hua and Alexander Gustafsson will also be fighting on that card. And BJ Penn coming back after being out almost a little bit over a year, 13 months. He's going to fight welterweight Rory McDonald, and their fight's significant because they've been doing voluntary anti-doping research, random testing. So we know for a fact that this one fight is not going to involve anybody on PEDs, unless they got some really good stuff that nobody can detect. We'll see.
Yeah, that one I'm looking forward to. There's been quite a bit of trash talk there, quite a bit of animosity between those two. And from what I just caught a glimpse of a headline, I didn't read the story, but apparently Gustafsson is already looking past Hua, and he says after he beats Hua, he wants a title shot, and I would advise him that that's never a wise move to look past anyone.
No.
So he's very confident, that's for sure. Yeah, I mean that's just not a good road to go down. I think you guys would agree with me on that one.
For sure. And you know, that's the UFC on Fox 5 card. They've been basically trying to put the best fights they possibly could on Fox. You know, this is a big card to seal the future of this. Deal for the UFC.
And
make sure that they
And I believe Nate Diaz has said that he's quite sure that he's not going to get any kind of a decision against Bendo. So that may be a barn burner if he's really going to go for the finish. See what happens.
Right. Well, speaking of PEDs, again, another UFC fighter has come out with a big statement estimating the percentage of UFC fighters who use performance-enhancing drugs. And this guy is from South Korea. The stun gun, Jung Hyun Kim, has said that 90% of UFC fighters use performance enhancers. And this is from an interview he did with a South Korean outlet, M-Fight. And this is his words. While a lot of people believe doping tests work, just like a breathalyzer test, you can get away with it by just controlling timing. Most of the steroids users just cycle and get by the tests. It's almost like other athletes look down on you as an idiot if you don't do steroids. It's like non-users are bicyclists, while steroid users are racing with motorcycles. But I am one of those idiots that don't use performance enhancers. I would say 90% of UFC fighters use performance enhancers. Now, I know that Krzysztof Soznitzky, I think, came out with a percentage of like 85% of all MMA fighters, I think he says, use some kind of performance-enhancing drug. And I just saw on TV the other day a commercial for this shit that you rub under your armpit for
Or you can also rub it elsewhere too. Okay, use your imagination on that one, because in that one, the sensitive part of the anatomy, the skin is very thin. So, but they also recommend you shave. I mean, come on, where are we going here? But it's and I wonder where the guys are getting these exact precise percentages here. If they're just pulling out of thin air, if they've got something to go by, that still seems pretty high.
They definitely didn't get the same first lesson in journalism that I did. And I had the high school newspaper going after being gone for years. I wrote this little column. There was a hats and coats rule. There's no hats and coats all of a sudden because it was a safety issue. And I was on the student side that tried to defend we need to wear hats and coats because that's our free speech rights. So I did this column, the yes and no of the issue, and a teacher did the yes, we need the ban, and I did the no column. But the 85% of kids don't want to go to school anyway. That, in the editorial, And, oh, man, I'd never seen the principal so mad. He came storming into my office, the newspaper office is there, and he's just, like, giving me hell. How can you write this? This is not true.
Where did you get that number?
100%. Did you do a poll?
Yes, sir. It was a very empirical study.
And this is a guy who actually was a lineman for the Steelers at one point, our high school principal. So he was pretty man, capable of doing damage, but he didn't hit me. But anyway, Dennis Hallman actually said it was 50%. He had been another guy who came out and said that a lot of guys were using it. Roy Nelson said many past opponents of his have actually confessed to they said Sosninski said 80%. I mean, sorry. And, of course, Nate Diaz pushed it to the limit and said that everyone in the UFC is on steroids, except for him and Nick, I guess. So, there you have it. I think we've talked enough about steroids tonight. I think it's been a theme. let's get to crime and punishment. Rasul Mirzaev, a one-time Bellator recruit who never got the chance to fight under that promotion's banner, has just recently been sentenced. He was sentenced, but he was released on the same day. Go figure. He was arrested for his role in the death of a student following a street fight in Russia, which is really putting it pretty nicely. I don't think it was a street fight at all, but we'll get to that. Mirzaev was given the maximum sentence of 2 years in prison. And after announcing the verdict, Judge Andrei Fedin ordered Mirzaev released on time served because he's been in the jail since August of 2011. Get this, under Russian law, 1 day in detention counts as 2 days in prison. Sounds like a deal to me.
Yeah.
Sounds like an excuse to delay your trial. Anyway, the incident happened, as I just said, in August of 2011, just days after Mirzaev reportedly signed with Bellator. Basically, Mirzaev and his girlfriend were leaving a Moscow nightclub when they became involved in a heated exchange with the victim, 19-year-old student Ivan Agafonov. And this story doesn't really describe it, but I think I remember when I first talked about this story on this show. And it involved a kid playing with some kind of remote control car, and he said something to the girl, and then the fighter said something back to him, and they punched him in the face just one time and knocked the guy to the ground, and he hit his head on a metal drain cover and died 4 days later.
Wow.
So, to some extent, it was the punch, but for the most part, I think it was him hitting his head on the ground, which is why the jury, I guess, had a tough time with this whole case or the judge. Anyway, the prosecution initially charged him with a more severe crime, but eventually requested it be reduced as questions arose as to, like I said, whether the victim died from the punch, his head striking the ground, or medical errors in his care. And after the verdict, the victim's father angrily burst out of the court. Mirzaev is a 26-year-old featherweight and reportedly tried to help the victim after realizing he was badly hurt. He also voluntarily turned himself into police, cooperated with the investigation, and sent money to the victim's family. But on another note, it was feared that the case would bring heightened nationalist tensions to the area, as Mirzaev is from Dagestan, while the victim was Russian. And I guess you have to be familiar with that rivalry to know what that means. Not really. Anyway, extra security measures were put in place prior to the verdict for that reason. Mirzaev was a 2010 Sambo World Champion in the 62-kilogram category, and he had been perfect at 5-0 in MMA at the time of his signing with Bellator. And he recently just defeated former Sengoku featherweight champ Masanori Kanahara. And it is not currently known whether he will resume his MMA career. But sounds pretty likely. All right. Well, I think think Mike Tyson is actually on CNN right now. Let me check this out. But I have a Mike Tyson story, so don't everybody go run and watch CNN. But I think he's on with Piers Morgan tonight. I thought I heard that last night. But anyway, if you really like Mike Tyson, you probably want to listen to this story, because he is starting the Mike Tyson Cares Foundation. And to prove that he cares about you, he's selling two tickets in a auction, actually. He's auctioning off tickets to the, I think, the Marquez versus Pacquiao fight. And it's going to be like a night out with Tyson. He's auctioning off the chance to be his guest at the fight. And it's two people, I guess, can go with him to the fight. And then they have a night out on the town in Vegas with Mike Tyson, hangover style.
Well, that would be interesting.
And this was a story. This is like one of the first stories I cut and pasted to my list of stories for this week. So, according to this, the highest bidder for the two tickets stands at $10,500, with over a week to go. So, I think that was last Wednesday. So, I think there must be like just a few days to go at this point. It's probably way higher than that now. But Tyson says, it will be like no other night. We're going to be vocal. It'll be exciting. We'll meet some of my buddies and we'll meet some boxers. It will be a dynamic evening. It's not going to be like a fight night without me, that's for sure. Starting a charity. Go ahead.
Have we covered the Ricky Hatton fight? Did I miss that?
No, we did not talk about that, but it's good that you mentioned that, because I would have forgotten. Because basically, he just quit the fight game again after the fight. Only got to the eighth round. I didn't see it. I didn't really read much about it, but it was an eighth or ninth round knockout, I think.
I didn't see it either, but I heard that he looked good early on and just ran out of gas, and I don't know. I mean, I'd heard he was up to about 210 pounds before he started losing weight, and in I believe one of the interviews I've seen of him, he was saying that he kind of enjoyed that, because that was his motive for getting down, and he really took his training a lot more serious by ballooning up so much like that. But you could argue that the other way too, and apparently he just felt that he had hit the wall, that this is the end of him.
Yeah, I just kind of wonder. It must have been really bad, I thought. I definitely did notice that he was kind of looking past this guy, talking about who he wanted to fight next, you know, talking about the whole division. And, you know, coming back from retirement, you don't talk like that.
I just can't understand these guys getting to that level and making a basic psychological mistake like that. I mean, you can't underestimate anyone. I remember that old Larry Merchant saying, boxing is the theater of the unexpected. And you just never know, ever. I mean, it's not scripted. There's no choreographer there. Yeah. So. And one other brief thing I wanted to mention, in the score fighting series, I was able to catch the main event there with Jordan Mine and M-E-I-N, I believe it was Mine, his name was pronounced, and Forrest Pettz. Did anyone see that one?
No, but I've seen Forrest Pettz fight in Massachusetts on the Mushin card that I went to, where Tim Sylvia fought Pujanowski, the world's strongest man. And put on a good show.
Yeah, well, as a disclaimer here, I'll say that I've not only trained with Forrest, but he's a personal friend of mine. You know, we've done things and hung out together. Well, my take on that fight was he came out with his normal style. You know, he has very, very, very good hands, and came out and he was just getting his timing down. And mine landed some good shots and actually put Forrest down. He was kind of beating him at his own game a bit, because in the past, Forrest has been laden prey, and that's how he, that was the book on how to beat him, but mine was actually winning the stand-up war. And Forrest shot in for a takedown, and mine landed enough shots, and, you know, Forrest has a very strong chin, and mine kept wailing away, but Yves Levine, I believe the referee, UFC referee, he finally was in a position where he had to stop it, and it was a minute 29 into the first round. This is a devastating setback for Forrest. And Forrest immediately just pounded the canvas. He was just so frustrated that he wasn't hurt, but, you know, when I'm, especially in this capacity on this show, I have to be objective about it. And you can't put the referee in a situation like that, you know, where you just never know when the next punch is going to be serious. So I'll have to email Forrest, and we'll see if we can get him on the show here, see where he's going in the future. So
yeah, definitely. I'm all for that. Tony, we got any big boxing from Fox matches coming up this weekend? Still there, Tony? You lose him? Tony, can you hear me now?
Well, sounds like he...
He's on break. He's there.
Hello?
Oh, there he is.
There.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, I must have hit you guys on mute.
Oh, I was like, oh, Tony's on break.
how long have you been not been able to hear me?
I just asked you a question. I didn't get a response. I was only...
Yeah, I heard you hear anything that I was talking about the Ricky Hatton fight?
No, nothing.
Well, no shit, really?
Yeah,
go back. But the way the conversation was going, it was like what everybody was saying, it was like, kind of playing off what I was saying too with the Hatton fight. I'm like, yeah, like I didn't get to see, I only saw the last few rounds, and Tom was like, yeah, I didn't get to see the fight. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then I was like, and then he talked about how much he had gained in weight and then coming back down and talking about he was looking to fight upcoming. And I was like making these little blurbs when you guys were saying it, and then I thought we were just rolling with it. So I tried this new iPhone tonight, and I really don't know how to use it yet.
Yeah.
So I must have hit the mute button when I hit the speaker button the one time.
You thought you were in on the conversation and you weren't.
No, I'm like sitting here the whole time. I thought I was contributing to the Ricky Hatton story. With regards to that, the one thing I guess I said that nobody heard was he was from Wilson Island until early, he was doing well. But Ricky's the type of fighter, he's always got to be in like top condition. And I think what really hurt him after the Mayweather loss was Ricky was always a face-first fighter. And he fought guys like Luis Collazo and, that southpaw style that really bothered him. And Ricky took a lot of flush shots. When he fought Mayweather, he basically tried to smother him. And then Mayweather finally figured about picking him apart and knocked him out. So then Ricky tries to, regroup his career, and he goes to Floyd Sr. as his trainer, who tried to train him in a completely different style. Tried to make him more of like a boxer and, more defensive focused, which, I mean, that's not his forte. Dance. It's okay to try to teach him some things to add to what he already does, but to take a championship level fight who's like his prime, you're never going to be able to teach him new tricks.
Very good point. Very good point.
Yeah, and I think it happened. And you saw that, I think, in the fight with Pacquiao. It was like, he was like kind of rushing in, but he wasn't smothering him. And he was standing right in that danger zone. And Kyle, I remember a fight years ago, an amateur fight. I was helping him in the corner. And it was a guy that I was on the team with, and he was fighting a guy that was taller than he was. And basically, when we told him, because he liked to usually fight on the outside, and box a little bit. He didn't like to get inside and mix it up. And we told him, if you're going to fight this guy, you got to do either one or two ways. You either got to get in his face and corral him because he gets flustered and he kind of loses his composure, or you got to stay way on the outside pick your spots, use angles, and then counterpunch him when he throws his jab or his right hand. And he couldn't do that. What he ended up doing was he stood right at the end of the guy's punches. He wasn't in close enough, and he wasn't far away enough. And what happened the whole time is he just got hit with every right hand the guy threw, and eventually he got stopped. And that just kind of reminded me of Ricky Hatton in that fight with Pacquiao. It was like he didn't know whether if he was going to come in or if he was going to play defense. And basically where he ended up being was a sitting duck. And like the punch that took Ricky out last week, it was a perfect body shot. It was kind of a punch that, you know, Mickey Ward made famous, of a left hook to the liver. You know, some of the I miss great fights. I can finish a lot of guys off with that shot. You know, I've seen fights where guys have been living all year. So if you go back and watch some of Mickey Ward's fights from like the late 90s, there have been fights that, you know, he was losing. And next thing you know, he just pulled out that left hook to the liver, and not only did the fight change, the fight was over.
It's a good weapon. Good little weapon there. But what do we got coming up this weekend for big fights?
I'm not on my computer right now. I know the one fight card on this weekend is Miguel Cotto on HBO, and he is stepping up to face the undefeated Austin Trout. Austin Trout, you know, is a very good fighter. He's undefeated. I believe he's 26-0. And like I said, I'm not on my computer right now, but I believe he has 17 knockouts. He's, you know, very quick. He's very elusive. He's got good skills. And they asked Cotto, you know, about looking such a tough fight after losing to Mayweather back in May. And he said, you know, basically that's what fighters do. You know, you go out there, you challenge yourself, you take the best competition on them. I've read some, you know, different predictions. I have one guy, and he is, you know, not really a big Cotto fan. And he was saying, oh, Austin Trout, you know, he's going to be his coming out party. He's going to use Cotto as a stepping stone. And somebody countered him with that and said, well, you know, he has kind of, he's like a Floyd Jr. He's not Floyd. He has a lot of his skills, but he's not Floyd. And Cotto made that fight pretty hard for Floyd. And then this guy put it, no, he didn't. Floyd toyed with him. And Floyd, you know, could have knocked him out at any time. And I was like, well, no, he didn't. You know, Cotto had him bleeding. Cotto had him hurt. You know, Floyd pulled away in the last four rounds. But at no point was it like this is a walkover. And at any point, he went away there and tried to trade with Cotto, or he lets Cotto get to his body. Because he's a little taller, he's a little lankier. He's going to have some problems. Because I'll tell you the one thing that Miguel Cotto can punch to the body. And I was telling my dad about a fight, I think it was back in 2005, fought a guy named by the name of Muhammad Abdullayev, who was a gold medalist for Kazakhstan, I think. And he beat Cotto in the Olympics back in 2000. So then they had a, you know, rematch in the pros. And you could just see that Cotto punished him. He beat him to the body, and you know, he was wearing him down. He had him busted up in the face. His nose was bleeding and everything. And he finally stopped him. He finally dropped him with a left hook to the shoulder. You know, a ninth or tenth round. That's pretty much a symbol where the guy had had enough. And that's how he beat him down. And finally, a punch to the arm was like, oh, this guy's like, all right, I've had enough. All right, don't know me. Throw him in the tent. So that's what you got with a guy like Miguel Cotto. He's a very physical fighter. I was down at the Atlantic City Convention Center when he defended his title against Alfonso Gomez a couple of years ago, and that was just a very brutal affair. I mean, he got Gomez to the body, and he really busted him up. So Austin Trout, like I said, is undefeated. He's a good fighter. He's got good skills. I mean, he's going to have to bring his lunchbox on Saturday night because he's, you know, especially fighting in Madison Square Garden, going to have a lot of Puerto Ricans there. You know, obviously, Cotto hasn't said anything yet, but, you know, he's probably, if he was smart, going to, you know, try to, you know, dedicate it to the memory of Hector Camacho to really get the Puerto Rican fans in a frenzy. And Austin Trout is going to be like stepping into a bee's nest.
Yeah. I think it's a good matchup. We'll see. Predictions one way or the other. I don't know enough about either guy. But Toto I've probably seen fight more. And, yeah, he's a tough fighter, but he's just, he's a little too unorthodox and bullish, I think, for a guy who's undefeated and sounds like a perfectionist. I don't know. He's, obviously, he probably doesn't have the type of experience that Cotto has, so you know, you have to take the trade-offs there and kind of consider it sort of even. So it should be a good fight. We'll see. But like I said, Mike Tyson is on CNN right now. If you guys want to check it out now or watch the replay later tonight, it's halfway through, what's his name, Piers Morgan. So I know CNN replays their whole primetime broadcast later at night. So not now. But he's on with his face tattoo and all.
I like the tattoo.
That's actually not that bad. It's a lot of crap for it, but
he's from Carrick.
Yeah. It's kind of like a fancy mustache.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
I don't remember a few months ago when we were doing my friend's bachelor party and we're going to Atlantic City, and I said, you know, we're all getting rolls from The Hangover. And, you know, I said, you know, as a groom, he's going to be Doug. We're going to get him drunk and lose him. I said, you know, his one fat cousin who always has a propensity to run his mouth, he could be Alan. The other cousin, we're like, you know, you're going to be Stu. I don't want to be Stu. We're like, well, who do you think you should be? He's like, I should be, what was the one guy's name? The cool guy, Bradley Cooper, whoever the hell he was. You know, I should be Phil. I'm like, no, you're not Phil. Your wife slaps you around, your pussy whips. You know, you're basically not allowed to go out and buy a baseball house. It's not a mission. You're Stu. He's like, well, who do you get to be? I said, I get to be Tyson, bitch. And I said, that means I get to brother in the face, which I kind of enjoy.
But, I mean, Tyson has really turned himself around. You know, it's not too long ago, he was talking about how he's bankrupt and he blew all his millions. And now he's starting a charity. He's traveling the world, you know, doing a lot of promotional stuff. I guess he's taking his one-man show across the country, too, eventually. So, look forward to. He'll probably stop in Philly. One of these days, I'm sure he'll stop in Philly.
Lucky Philly, you know, sure.
Yeah. But, crazy character. And it's amazing to see him in his old age, a little more mellow and composed, not swearing at reporters and breaking cameras. But, yeah. Anyway. Getting back to the UFC, we talked a little bit about UFC and Fox 5 earlier, and I just kind of wanted to run down the card here. I wasn't aware how stacked this undercard was as well. Mike Swick is coming back. Swick is fighting Matt Brown on this one. Both very technical fighters. They've been around a long time. Both have 15 wins. Brown has 11 losses. Swick only has 4. But Brown is pretty competent. He's had a good run here in the UFC. He hasn't had a title shot or anything, but he's definitely been around a long time. I think he was an Ultimate Fighter. And speaking of the Ultimate Fighter, the winner of the Tough Live series is back. Michael Chiesa. He'll be fighting Marcus Levasseur, who is 22-6. And I know Chiesa won the Ultimate Fighter and all that, but that's a lot of experience, 22-6, for him to be facing in his first official UFC fight after that whole deal went down at the Tough fight. So, I don't know. It kind of reminds me, actually, I just heard this last week, Ryan Couture, Randy Couture's son, is going to be fighting KJ Nunes on the Strikeforce event in January.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a step up.
That is a huge step up.
Yeah,
I've
gigantic step up. Yes, I agree. This
is
a
mean, this kid just got into fighting. I interviewed him myself when I was out there, and you know, he's just getting into it, just learning. It's not something that he came to a decision on early in his life. He just made this decision to follow in his father's footsteps. So, I mean, I know you have a famous father, and you have an advantage in that, you know, he's got his own gym, and you got the whole setup up there with all these other fighters that you can train with. But you'd have to have made a shitload of progress to be fighting a guy like KJ Nunes.
How old is Randy's son? Do you know offhand?
28, 29, maybe.
Okay, and maybe he's thinking, I've got to make up lost time pretty quick, but this is a tough way to do it. Very tough way to do it. And I guess on the one hand, depending on his mindset, he may look at it, well, this will be a good test of where I'm at. I really don't have a lot to lose. If I come up short, I made the lead too quick. But sometimes, and again, all of us know this too, one punch or one fight can end a career.
Right.
So,
well, I don't know. Maybe he'll pull off the big upset. But I would definitely bet on KJ on that one. No disrespect to Ryan, but
sure.
You have learned a heck of a lot since the last fight I saw. And I just kind of feel for him because, you know, I met the kid myself and I want to see him get beat up. So I kind of question the Strike Force people doing that. But then again, the UFC was always known to throw Randy Couture to the wolves when he was mouthing off against the organization. Ryan, I don't think has said anything bad, but I know Randy, they threw him in with the toughest of the tough when he was having his to the fold. Getting back to this UFC and Fox 5 card, we have Brandon Schaub, 8-3, fighting LeVar Johnson, who's 17-6. That'll be a nice, pretty
good. That's an
intriguing. So. And there's a lot of Ultimate Fighter guys there. Schaub is another heavyweight season guy. Speaking of Ultimate Fighter 2, we got Nam Phan, 18-10, fighting Dennis Seaver, who's 20-8. And Phan, I mean, not to just a cheesy little saying here, but he's really a fan favorite. more than anything, because of his controversial fight there, getting a bad decision against him. And then I forget the guy offhand who he fought that happened, but they had a rematch, I think Fan won. But up and down, but just people like to watch him fight. He does have some vicious body shots. He likes to throw his left hooks, too. But Seaver's been around for a long time. He's been in the UFC for a little bit longer than Nam. And I think he's not a very exciting fighter. So, we'll see. I mean, he can be, but
I think my take on him, I mean, he's very technical, and yet sometimes he looks so good, and then just when you think he's really moving up, bang, all of a sudden there's just a setback. So he's been kind of streaky. So this is going to be a good test for him, too.
Yeah, I think this is a good matchup. I think Nam could catch him with the boxing. If he can keep it on the feet, but I think Seaver is probably the better BJJ guy. We also have Mike Easton, 13-1, fighting Rafael Asencayo, who's 18-4. That's a decent matchup there. A couple guys from different seasons of the Ultimate Fighter. We got Ramzy Najim, who's only 6-2. I don't know how that's possible. He's been in the UFC a good little while. We'd figure he'd have more fights than that, but he's only 6-2, and he's fighting Joe Proctor, who's 8-1, and he's actually from a season after Ramzy was on, I think. I think it was on the Tough Live season, if I remember correctly, but I could be wrong on that. We got Eve Edwards fighting again against Jeremy Stevens, and it's kind of hard to believe these guys haven't fought each other yet. They've both been around for a while. Eve Edwards is 41-18-1, and Stevens is 28-0, 20 wins, 8 losses.
Now, what about Stevens' legal situation? Have we heard any more about that?
I'm sure they must have cleared it up. I know that he was extradited back to Iowa and all that, so I think he had his court appearance and they figured everything out. I don't think he's off the hook completely yet. You know, he's still probably has to go to trial. But they're really, you know, they're going after him hard on that. And I don't know whether this is the same fight that he was supposed to have before that he had to pull out of because of that or not, but it sounds familiar, so maybe it is. Anyway, we got three more fights here. Henry Martinez, 9-2, fighting Darren Cruikshank, who's 11-2. And we have Scott Jorgensen, I don't know if he pronounces the J, but it's his record is 13-6, fighting John Halbert, who's 7-3. Tim Means, who's 18-3-1, fighting Abel Trujillo, who's 9-4. That's UFC on Fox 5 next Saturday. And not much else going on in the MMA world. We do have a little bit of a story here on Alistair Overeem. We talked a little bit about how the UFC is being allowed to promote him, or promote his fight, even before his suspension runs out. They haven't, Nevada State Athletic Commission has not issued any kind of, official sanctioning that he's going to, or promise that he's going to get his suspension lifted when he appears before them. But apparently it's all but a formality because they said, okay, Dana White, go ahead and promote. It's still a fight in February. But this is another vein of Alistair Overeem's dramatic backstory here. We have a lawsuit development. His former fight camp and management team, Golden Glory, have resolved all their outstanding legal issues with Overeem, and they reached a settlement to dismiss the dueling lawsuits. They sued him, he sued back, or vice versa, one or the other. But in a press release distributed to the media by Golden Glory through their attorney, it was announced that the two sides reached an amicable resolution to their dispute. Okay, Overeem originally sued Golden Glory last November, alleging they had refused to pay over $151,000 he deserved. He was also seeking a court order to break his existing management contract with them. Golden Glory eventually countersued, saying his claims were scurrilous. Overeem had been part of the team's stable for over a decade, winning not only the Strikeforce belt, but also championships in Dream and K1, where he was the World Grand Prix titleist. And according to Golden Glory's release, there were no fewer than 6 law firms involved in the messy suit. Everyone worked extremely hard to resolve these matters so that all parties can walk away and move forward with the Glory World Series promotion in Europe, Japan, and the USA, and Alistair Overeem can concentrate on his fighting career with his new manager, Glenn Robinson. So, with all that behind him, Overeem will still need to get his relicensing accomplished before the UFC 156 bout on Super Bowl Saturday can be made official. And he can reapply following the expiration of his suspension on December 27th. That's all we have pre-arranged for this part. Anybody else got anything?
Oh, since this is the PED evening, apparently Stephen Bonner failed his test for after UFC 153, and he told Dana that his excuse was he apparently is going into pro wrestling, so he wanted to get a little bigger. Dana was kind of upset about that he didn't tell him before. So the PED stories just continue. And then we had someone from CBS Sports basketball, a gentleman, Seth Davis, and he went on a Twitter rant about, what's the headline here? Goes off on homoerotic MMA, doesn't want his sons watching, and wrote a bunch of stuff about that. And then he immediately retracted it, I guess, when someone brought up the fact that Sports Illustrated website has a whole page devoted to it, or that CBS Sports has a partnership with MixedMartialArts.com, so I'm apparently someone got to him and talked. But I think stuff like that says a lot about the person saying it.
Yeah.
I'll leave it at that. You know, I mean, how someone could look at that and get that image, what does that say about him?
Reminds me of the guy from The Breakfast Club. You know, the I don't know the guy's name offhand, the actor, but the guy who played the punk. And
Nelson,
yeah. He says to the jock, and he finds out he's arrested. Oh, what are you like rolling around on the floor with other guys in tights?
Well, in fact, I remember Shane Carwin was having a question and answer session on the Underground, and someone asked him, how would you feel if you found out your opponent was gay? And Shane had a pretty good comeback to that. He said, well, there's nothing sexual about fighting. Are you okay? Are you all right? So, kind of like that. And then one last thing. Apparently Dana's been on a campaign now to shame fighters with this, are you a real fighter, because real fighters take fights on extremely short notice. And I guess his latest target has been Sheck Kongo. I guess he's turned down, he turned down the Roy Nelson fight. And apparently there was another one in the past. And so Dana's all upset about that. And so it's reading a story about how, you know, you can kind of see that both ways too, though, because enough losses and you're out of the equation. So maybe it's back to what you were saying. That.
You know, there's a lot of these issues with Dana White where, and the U.S. is just having these growing pains, and Dana White's just putting out all these demands and forgetting that this is the way he set it up to be. You know, he's blaming all these fighters for being fat and lazy because they're making more money than ever. But at the same time, you know, he's the one that set it up so that, you know, they have to train hard because they have to put on a performance. You know, so they're trying to get the knockout of the night.
Right.
Exactly.
And the final paragraph of that, and I'll quote this, these aren't just fighters. They're professional fighters. Every decision they make needs to be one where they weigh the pros and cons and do the right thing to ensure that they get the most out of their career. There isn't a UFC pension plan. There's no 401k with corporate matching. It's here and now. Make what you can while you can. And it's a damn shame that Dana White would put fighters in a position that makes it so clear that they are a little more than spots on a fight card.
Yeah, and to put a guy like that in charge of an organization where he should know, I mean, granted he hasn't had an actual fight, but he was involved in boxing at some level where he was at the gym, he was training at one point, he saw what guys boxing have to go through. I'm not sure if he saw any pro fighters there, you know, getting ready for their fights, but I'm sure he had to run into some along the way at some point before he became a box instructor out in Vegas. Whatever part of the boxing game he played in, you know, he must have seen it, where guys would have to take fights on short notice and what would happen when they did. It's never a good thing if you're not ready at all times. So, you know, there's certain situations where you might not be injured, but you got something that's just really bothering you. You know, you're sore in a certain area. You're going to take a week off. And what if Dana White calls you during that week when you feel like, oh, geez, maybe if I had 2 weeks' notice, I'd do it. But no, I just spent a week off, so I can't do it.
Yeah.
You know, little things like this are big deals to these fighters. And, you know, lots on the line. Dana White's made it that way. And
well,
he's like, I don't like my own sandbox now. I want it to be perfect.
Yeah, and I'll steal a quote from Rich Franklin, and I know both you guys can appreciate this, that being in shape is one thing, but being in fight shape is a whole other level. And there's no way that any human being can stay in fight shape 52 weeks out of the year. I've never heard of it in my life. I refuse to believe it can be done. You can't stay at a peak condition at all times. That's my 2 cents worth. My humble opinion.
Yeah. And if he doesn't want guys to get injured, you know, he shouldn't be trying to set up so many fights on short notice, you know. Just because a guy gets injured doesn't you have to throw another fighter at him. I mean, I can understand what the main event, but the other thing was, you know, these guys that he was calling out were being asked to fight Cormier, some of them. And who wants to go over to Strikeforce to fight this guy? It's like considered promotion to these guys, so it's almost like it's like an audition for being fired.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
right, very good point. It's just
over here, you lose, then you're out for good.
Right. It's just like a no-win proposition.
Yeah. So I mean, business decision wise, I think those guys were smart to turn down those fight opportunities with him. I think Matt Mitrione was one of them. I mean, that guy, you know, he's probably going to be around a while because he's a character. He talks a lot. He speaks his mind and all that, and he fights well. But he's also capable of getting beaten up pretty bad, even though he's got hard hands and he's done well. For the most part, I think he's only got one loss that I've seen in the UFC. But, you know, it's like some of these guys are getting to the point where they are such big names that Dana can't really fire them for refusing to fight or anything like that, like he maybe could do before, but now he can't. So I think it's turning into a little bit of a monster for White, and he doesn't like it. He doesn't like being the guy who can't dictate everything and say how it's going to be.
Yeah, I mean, there are just so many unintended consequences, and I mean, and if everyone felt that their career was on the line if they didn't answer the call to fight next week, then they're going to be overtraining constantly, which is going to lead to more injuries, which we're right back to square one again. So I don't think there's an answer to it, but the answer is not being in perfect shape constantly.
Right. Well, either way, we know Dana White is not very educated when it comes to the fight game that he goes out there and promotes every day. As far as what it actually takes to be a fighter, and it's so ironic because he's the one that gave the famous speech, you know, do you want to be an effing fighter?
Yeah. Well, which was a good speech, though. I did like
it. Was, you know. But, I don't know, he just continues to prove that it's a big mistake to have a guy who never had a single fight competitively be out there as a mouthpiece for a fighting organization.
With the attitude that he has.
Right. I mean, if you were, you know, a big-time fan, never had a competitive fight, but you knew everything there is to know about fighting, then I would give you a pass. But Dana doesn't even seem to know.
Or at least get in the gym and train hard with the guys. At the very least.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not like being in a real fight, but still, it is in a sense. I mean, if you're in there actually sparring and rolling and having to keep yourself in the shape and being around the guys and knowing the sacrifices they have to make to get ready for this, just what a big event this is, the challenge, the drain on your body, that would make a big difference, I think.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, too, that he came into the fighter house on the Ultimate Fighter in previous weeks there, and he told the fighters he was disappointed with the level of fighting. Even there, at that level, you know, these guys are first coming in, and they're being told, you know, you're not living up to expectations. You're not fighting up to your potential. You got to put on a show. And that whole thing, it's going to come back to bite them, because...
Mm-hmm.
I can see a day when one of those NFL type of lawsuits where they sue the whole NFL because of injuries sustained from, you know, for one reason or another, they didn't do something here, they did something there that they shouldn't have. You know, if it ever gets to that point where guys get injured because of that, trying to put on a show, and that's the emphasis all the time, rather than put on a technical fight or fight your style. You know, you got to put on a show. You know, it's got to be knockout or toe-to-toe face punching or nothing at all. And, you know, once you get that mentality into these guys, it could encourage you to hurt somebody else rather than fight a smart fight.
Sure.
You're just trying to hurt the other guy, and you're going to get hurt in a lot of situations. So I think that's just a bad idea, the way they just put so much emphasis on that. You know, granted, everybody likes to see that type of fight. They're going to clap for it, but let the fans encourage it at the event, you know. Don't have the manager of the whole thing getting on your case because you don't have that type of fight. I think that's just a bad seed to be growing
yeah.
in these guys' minds that they have to put on a show. Just doesn't make sense to me that they would emphasize that so heavily to the point where even these new guys are getting that speech that you know, they're not fighting up to potential and they gotta step it up. Because at that point, I mean, you know, you got these guys, they're in a competition. They're in a tournament. So it's a whole different ball game to where you have a full training camp and you can get ready for each and every fight individually. Here, you're in a tournament. You don't even know who you're going to fight next. And you have to save yourself so that you don't get to the point where you're too injured to fight, you know, your next fight. So there's so many different things where you have to fight smart. And he's going in there to tell them to fight dumb, basically. Go for the knockout. Put on the show. So, bad idea, Dana. I think you ought to reconsider your position on that whole thing.
And it's a tough situation because you can put yourself in the shoes of the fighter. You want to please the boss. I mean, that's human nature. And you want to pick up fans, but you also want to win and get that contract so you can train full time. So it's not easy for these guys. Not easy at all.
And for all of all people who should know that, it's the president of the organization. He just continues to show that he just has no clue about what fighters actually go through. And it's a shame, you know, because if he did have a grasp on all that, he would have a lot more fans than he does. And I still think that too many people like him and take him at face value don't realize that he really doesn't do all that much, but... You know, he does have a good conversational tone. He gets people talking. He has a great relationship with the media. He speaks his mind, and people like that. But I just wish there was more sense on his mind for him to speak. Well, on that note, on the Dana bashing note, I think we're gonna call it a night, and we're gonna try to get a big guest on next week. And we want to wish the FBI good luck on their event. Hopefully they win. I have nothing against the cops, but I have more of a relationship with the fire guys, so I want to see them do well. And, you know, obviously the charity that they're going to represent and help out is going to do well. It's Madison Square Garden on December 8th. Big show, FDNY versus NYPD Amateur Boxing. And look out for Felipe Irizarry, who is going to be at 152 pounds, fighting against Tuesday. And thanks to our sponsors, Cocaine Energy Drink and ScienceShop.com. Check them out. And until next week, adios. That's all I got.
All right, guys.
Hasta la vista. Talk to you next week.
All right, let's enjoy the fight.
Good night, folks. Thanks for stopping by.